I'm Gordon Evans, and I'm speaking with Dina Temple Raston. She reports on counterterrorism for NPR. On Monday, February 4th, she will speak in Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids as part of the World Affairs Council of West Michigan's Great Decisions discussion series. Her address is called New Threat Assessment, Defending America on a Budget. Dina Temple Raston, thank you very much for taking some time to speak with us.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Can America truly be defended on a budget? And I suppose, will some people hear on a budget and think that means on the cheap and get concerned?
Well, there has been a lot of money poured into counterterrorism for quite some time now. And you know, I was at an event last night in which people were talking about there used to be a problem in the counterterrorism centers. They had $1 billion to spend, and they didn't know how to spend it. And also, the terrorism threat has really changed. We're not talking about core al-Qaeda anymore. We're talking about pockets of al-Qaeda that have been able to survive. And so you have a pocket in Somalia. You have a pocket in Algeria and Mali. And I think the other difference is that the U.S. is no longer going it alone when it comes to fighting terrorism. I think Mali is a really good example. I mean, the French are taking the lead there, and the U.S. is helping. In Libya, the U.S. was not in charge of that operation. Other people were. So I think that sort of changed the calculus as well. I think a lot of other countries are banding together, realizing that terrorism is not just a threat against the United States, but a wider threat against all of them.
Is the whole idea of terrorist networks, are those networks becoming less centralized than they were perhaps a decade ago?
Yeah, a lot of people in the counterterrorism world where I live, we say we've gone to Al-Qaeda 3.0, right? Al-Qaeda 1 was Al-Qaeda core. Al-Qaeda 2.0 was Al-Qaeda's affiliates, basically the metastasis of ideas that Al-Qaeda embraced. And then they were sort of set up in regional affiliates. So you had Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which is the one that's sort of in Mali now. You had Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which was in Yemen. It was basically a conglomeration of Saudis and Yemenis who came together under the Al-Qaeda banner. You had Al-Shabaab in Somalia, which may not have the Al-Qaeda moniker, but certainly was affiliated with Al-Qaeda. So these were all these groups. And if you take a look at, for example, Somalia, it has been very effective at stamping out al-Shabaab. And they actually now have an elected president, which a year ago most people wouldn't have expected. They have an elected parliament. And they've really been able to push al-Shabaab out of Somalia, or at least into small pockets of Somalia. And at one point, al-Shabaab actually had Mogadishu, the capital. So they're looking at Somalia now as a model for what might happen in Mali, that essentially you get an African-based troops in there. You get some help from Western countries in terms of intelligence and maybe planning, and then you let them take care of it themselves. It worked in Somalia. It's unclear whether it'll work in Mali, but I think that's what we're going to see them trying to do.
Does that decentralization and the rise of splinter groups make it more difficult for the United States to try and mount an effective counterterrorism strategy?
Well, it makes it more diffuse for certain. I mean, I think one of the things that the good thing about Al-Qaeda core no longer being as strong as it was is that I think that the concern about there being an attack on the homeland, something on the scale of 9/11, is a very, very small concern now. And for a long time, that was always the big worry. It is very hard to get an attack in this country. This is one of the reasons why Al-Qaeda, in all its different iterations from affiliate to core, have tried to seduce young men in this country and say, attack while you're here. Don't go to a camp to train. Don't come and see us. You know, if you're in the United States and you agree with us, then, you know, buy a gun or you know, do something on your own here. We'll help you if we can, but we really want you to be independent. So that's what it's sort of devolved down to. The splintering of groups has been going on for now, I guess, probably 3 or 4 years in a big way. And it makes it harder to fight in that you don't have them all corralled in one place. But at the same time, the threat is at a different level. I mean, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Qaeda's arm in Yemen, certainly tried to attack the U.S. at the homeland, right? They're the ones who were behind the underwear bomber in 2009 on Christmas Day that tried to take down that plane over Detroit. They were the ones who tried to send cargo bombs through cargo planes to the United States. And they were very focused on that. Now, we understand that their second in command, a guy named Saeed al-Shiri, may in fact have been killed just several, or at least confirmed killed several days ago. The Yemenis say that he died in an attack. He was a former Guantanamo detainee and was very, very focused on the United States. So as these people who are focused on the United States peel off, the question is going to be, where will the attacks come next? And those are going to be soft targets. Those are going to be things like embassies and maybe shopping malls or places where Americans or Westerners gather. That's very hard to protect against, but it's also not on the level of 9/11.
But in a way, is that a little more scary to the average American citizen that the shopping mall they're at could be the victim of some sort of a random attack as opposed to a big target such as the World Trade Center or the Pentagon?
Absolutely. Except then again, you have to be at the exact wrong place at the exact wrong time. Since 9/11, the number of people who have died in a terrorist attack sort of inspired by al-Qaeda is 13. And that was the – actually, it's 17. And 13 of those people were at Fort Hood, where Major Nidal Hassan opened fire on fellow soldiers there. So, I mean, there hasn't been a lot of this. There's been a lot of preemptive arrests, which are controversial, people who the FBI are worried are going to act, and then an FBI informant is injected into that particular plot, and then they basically provide fake explosives, and someone will dial a number saying that they want to blow up, say, a Christmas tree bombing in Portland. That court case is going on. And, of course, it's inert explosives, and they're arrested. There's been a fair number of things like that, but these are like small bore things, and I'm not sure that you necessarily link them to Al Qaeda. I mean, we have a problem with white supremacists in the country too, and you could be in the wrong shopping mall when somebody like that gets angry.
Your reporting on the attack in Algeria has revealed something perhaps a little different about Al Qaeda. And that is sort of maybe a difference amongst the terrorists themselves in terms of ideology and criminal intent. Explain how this has played out, particularly on that BP attack.
Well, the BP attack, what made it so interesting is that we believe that the mastermind of it, or at least the man who took credit for it or claimed responsibility for it, was a man named Mukhtar Belmukhtar, who has been well known in al-Qaeda circles because he's basically a terrorist slash criminal. He's a master smuggler in North Africa. And he was one of the founders of al-Qaeda's arm in North Africa, known as al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And AQIM was always sort of a black sheep of the al-Qaeda affiliate system, largely because they did so many kidnappings and did so much smuggling that some other al-Qaeda affiliates and even al-Qaeda Corps grumbled and said, look, you're kind of besmirching our name here. You're making us more criminal than ideological. Well, as it turns out, this may be the model that other al-Qaeda affiliates are turning to because al-Qaeda Corps doesn't have money for them anymore, because the deep pocket donors in Saudi and other places maybe are not funding them in the same way that they used to be funded. So they're increasingly turning to crime. So al-Qaeda's arm in Iraq, for example, robs banks. Al-Qaeda's arm in Somalia, this al-Shabaab group, they do money laundering by basically trading for money. And you have now al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, at least this offshoot of Mukhtar Belmukhtar, that is renowned for drug smuggling, gun smuggling, diamond smuggling, cigarette smuggling, virtually everything. And this was not supposed to be what al-Qaeda was supposed to be about. It was supposed to be sort of a pure ideological movement. And certainly when they were spending Osama bin Laden's money, they could be more virtuous than now. But that virtue seems to have knocked down a peg or two.
Do the terrorist groups, and al-Qaeda in particular, keep adapting? Do they keep finding ways to survive, to recruit new members, and to find the money that they need? Are they always reinventing themselves in a sense?
That's been the issue. I mean, one of the things that I say when I go out and speak to people is that Al-Qaeda is a little bit like Robert De Niro is in the movie Cape Fear. I don't know if you remember that movie or not, but he's sort of a psychopathic murderer. And every single time you think that Nick Nolte and his family have killed him off, you know, he's drowned, he's left the houseboat or whatever it is, he rises up out of the water with some new weapon and surprises them. And that's kind of what Al-Qaeda has managed to do. Every single time Al-Qaeda has been written off, whether it was, you know, the U.S. using its drone program to wipe out its top leadership and its middle management, whether it was killing Osama bin Laden, every single time, or whether it was choking off its financing, every single time Al-Qaeda has found a way to morph and adapt and come back again. Remember, after the Arab Spring, there were a lot of people who were saying Al-Qaeda's over. You know, their narrative that you have to have violence to change things, like changing the leadership in Egypt, was wrong because, look, it was changed through relatively peaceful protests. But a lot of us in the counterterrorism community were saying, wait a minute, there's a lot of expectation here in the wake of the Arab uprisings. And if those expectations are dashed or not met in some way, it'll give Al-Qaeda an opening. And that's exactly what's happened. Al-Qaeda has taken advantage of the chaos. They've taken advantage of the vacuum that has been there. And I wouldn't say that they're stronger than ever, but they certainly are not dead yet.
And as you reported back in December, you had a story where you said that judging by the rise of the groups linked to Al-Qaeda, the end of the war on terror is still a ways off. Is it even possible right now to comprehend the idea of the end of the war on terror, knowing what Al-Qaeda has been able to do to reinvent itself?
Yes, I think it is, actually. I think that the Obama administration is already thinking through some of these issues. I mean, the reason why you can theoretically fly drones in Pakistan and fly U.S. drones in Yemen and launch these various operations that the U.S. has, for example, just sending people into Somalia to kill a Al-Qaeda operative there named Nabhan. The reason why they can do this is because of an authorization that Congress gave them just days after 9/11, which basically gave them carte blanche to use military force wherever they need to fight Al-Qaeda. So every time people have complained about possible American overreach, one of the many arguments they use is, hey, we have the AUMF, the authorization to use military force, and because of that and self-defense, we're allowed to do what we do. But increasingly, the Obama administration is realizing that as you get down to sort of lower-level people in Al-Qaeda that they're killing, as opposed to leaders and middle management, that argument rings a little hollow, and that they're going to have to figure out, for example, how they can fly drones in other countries if they have permission, if they don't have the authorization for military force. And what are they going to do with detainees in Guantanamo if the war on terror is actually declared over? How do you keep people there in Guantanamo if there's no war anymore? These are all things that they're thinking through. And the fact that they're thinking through them, I think, says to me that they see that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and this isn't the endless war, and they have to think through the legal issues that go along with that.
Let me, though, ask you, and perhaps as a way of wrapping this up, during the Bush administration, there were a lot of people who criticized the national security state, if you will, that was created after the terrorist attacks in 2001. In many ways, President Obama has continued that. You've reported on some of this. You wrote a book about the Lackawanna Six, as they were known. Do you think that the Obama administration has made any meaningful change there in terms of the so-called national security state, some of the things about privacy? And has the critics of the Bush administration, have they gone largely silent during the years that President Obama has been in office?
I think when most people look at the so-called national security apparatus or national security state, I think they even divide the Bush administration differently. I think they think of it as the first term in which there were a number of oversteps, and I think everyone agrees with that. And then Bush 2, in which a lot of those oversteps were corrected. Warrantless wiretaps were way pulled back. FISA courts got beefier. They actually tried to set up some sort of system at Guantanamo that was less of a kangaroo court, although some people still think that military commissions aren't constitutional or even approaching justice, although they've been reformed. All these things have been going on to make these changes. And so when you talk about Obama not change the Obama administration not changing much from the Bush administration, you have to be pretty careful to delineate between the second term that President Bush had and how many changes there are from that. And critics are right. From Bush 2, there are not a lot of changes to the Obama administration. And I think the Obama administration feels a little uncomfortable about that. And that's one of the reasons why we're behind the scenes hearing a lot about how they're trying to codify things so that in the future there can't be those kinds of overreaches that there were during Bush 1. And that's why I was talking earlier about this idea of actually having a playbook for drone attacks. It's unclear that that will ever be unclassified, but they're actually circulating something now within the administration so that there are codified legal rules that actually coincide with international norms that they can fall back on, as opposed to a bill and law that Congress passed in the heady days right after 9/11.